The Extra Ball.
Welcome to this most champion of podcasts, The Extra Ball. Thanks for subscribing. I'm Dan Moylan and I'm joined remotely by Michael Normanson.
Hello.
And also by Moscow White, Daniel Chapman.
Hello.
That Soccer Supremo mug is back and up for grabs this week. There was a board game in 1991 called Soccer Supremo. We played it in the early episodes of The Extra Ball. And to honour its memory, we give you the chance to win a mug on every episode of The Extra Ball. If you want to get involved, a WhatsApp voice memo will give you the best chance of winning the mug. Leave us a question that we can address further on in this podcast. Failing that, you can always do a written message as well if you fancy, but they're not considered as highly rated as voice memos because we want to get your voice on the show. WhatsApp is the place to do it, 07899555459, or you can head to thesquareball.net/WhatsApp and that'll redirect you and fill in the number. We'll do this week's contributions at halftime during this show and we'll pick the mug winner at the end. First is the quiz, or the setup for the quiz, aka Jemmy McMastermind, Quizzy Brown, catchphrases Richardson von Hausen, etc., etc. Much debate off air before we started recording about whose turn it is. It's my turn, I believe. So
you've prepared brilliantly.
Given that I found this out only moments ago, let me tell you, there's going to be a treat in store. We're going to be working our way through a list at the end of this show, and it'll be the first person to get one wrong will lose. And that thriller minute quiz, end of the show. First of all, let's talk about the fact that Leeds United are the champions of the championship, because that's happened recently. And that was pretty nice. We've talked about it lots on the Match Ball and on the main podcast. But we want to take a revisit on our despair from a year previously, the Griefcast, where we jumped into the studio. If you haven't heard it, it's worth going back and listening to this. We jumped into the studio straight away at full time after the Derby defeat in the playoff semi-final second leg and let it all hang out. Is it worth now maybe saying why we did that? Why did we do it?
Because we thought we were going to go to Wembley and we wanted to go in and record a really joyous thing. But instead, we had to just go in and weep, which I think was as useful, probably. Maybe even more useful than going in and saying how great we were and how we were going to be promoted.
I remember distinctly having to bully you both into it because you both just wanted to go home and cry in your beds. But I was adamant that this was the thing we should do. And I was then amused when I looked on the my podcast app to find it again, that we described it as a bonus Griefcast, as if we were giving everybody something really exciting and lovely that they would like. Bonus. It's a dead dog in a box.
It started the Match Balls though, didn't it? It was the first one we'd done. So it made us realise that there was appetite for stuff straight after a game. So that was nice. In fact, it's strange saying about how I had to be persuaded to go in. I think it might be because my voice was absolutely knackered as well. Listening to it, I'm completely sober in it, but I sound both drunk and ill at various points of it. But neither of those things were true. I was just very upset and had been shouting a lot.
A year on from it, how do you look back on the Derby game now? I think it was probably worth going through that pain to tee us up for winning the league in the style that we did. I think it's made it all the sweeter.
It's one of those things, once everything's fine, you can look back at bad things, generally speaking, and as long as they've been put right, and think, oh, well, that wasn't so bad. Just like when, you know, you've had bad relationships and jobs and stuff that have led you to other things. And you could then go, oh, well, that doesn't really matter too much anymore because now I'm where I am. Had we not gone up this year, I would still look back at it as being incredibly painful.
I actually, in preparation for this podcast, watched the game.
Full thing?
Whole thing. Even I got as far as the starting the on-pitch interviews with Derby's players. And at that point, I had to give up because the thing that I really was reminded of that maybe doesn't come through in the Griefcast and in how we remember it because we were so tied up in what Leeds United had done is just what an unpleasant bunch of Derby County had and continue to have as players. I look back on it not with distance anymore. I kind of look back on it at something that I watched this morning and that made me angry.
I watched back the highlights of it. Well, if you can call them that. The Dallas goals were good, but looking back at their players, I think it was their third goal. I can't remember which one it is now, but it's basically, no, it's their second, sorry. It's Keogh to Wilson to Mount for their, and you just think, gone, gone, gone. And that's why they've not done very well this year, because they've not kept the team together, whereas we have.
I still haven't been able to make sense of that game, but I know that recording that podcast did me a little bit of good. I still can't quite get my head around what happened. It just went beyond everything that Leeds United have ever done. And you could tell in our voices, you could hear when we got in the studio. Wasn't great, was it?
Initial reaction then?
It's a bit shit that, wasn't it? Bit annoying.
I'm gutted in bizarre ways. That was absolute chaos. I don't know what happened. I can't remember Stuart Dallas's second goal. I can't remember their, which one I wrote it down. The goal after half time that Derby scored. I was watching it. I looked every single thing. I watched every component, saw all the players move, saw the ball. I can't tell you what happened. It's like, but I don't know.
I think basically it was all going fine and then Kiko Casilla happened.
You're right, Michael. You sound absolutely washed out there.
I'm all like, ah, I don't know what it is. I think I'm just struggling to get the words out of my overused mouth. That sounds filthy. I've got a bad throat. I've been shouting is what I mean. I sound even more emotional on this clip.
Stand and I ended up walking down to the front. I was going down towards the gangway, but then ended up like just walking down back to the front. There was a little girl who must have been 7 or 8, absolutely in tears. And I just wanted to say, you've got a fucking lifetime of this.
This has been good.
Yeah.
You should have been in the last fucking 12 years.
Even though you were...
You miserable little bitch.
I don't regret a word of that.
I wonder what became of her. If we'd have been allowed in the stadium for the games where we won the title, would you have been roaming around the East Stand trying to find her? Hey, what do you think now, eh?
I'd have been doing Frank Lampard crying gestures at her. Oh, it's all so terrible, isn't it? I've only won a trophy in one of my seasons that I've been supporting Leeds. Pathetic.
Both barrels, Michael, both barrels. You're absolutely right, yeah. Yeah, I can remember just the strangeness of leaving the ground that night. And as I hinted at in that clip, I started walking down towards the exit of the East Stand, but found myself unable to leave because the players were just coming round on their lap of whatever it was that they were doing. And Phillips was in tears, and I wanted to run down there and give him a hug. And I just happened to see that little girl close by, also in tears. And I remember at the time I was trying to catch Phillips' eye and trying to do that the chin up gesture, you know, that Mourinho did, where you tap in your chin, raise your chin. That one. I wanted to say, keep your chin up. It's all right, Calvin. Everything will be fine. Also, don't leave us, please. We need you.
It's almost hearing you all upset about Calvin being upset. It does make it all the better for what's happened to him this year. And hearing the stuff from the other week about how he did nearly leave because it essentially broken him and there was loads more money on offer. It's right what he did in staying and completing the job because it was so close and it's so perfect for him, I think, to have not ended it that way. It sounds like he's leaving us now. He's not, he's staying forever. But for him to have overcome this himself, I'm sure it must actually help him because he must feel a bit like this game's out of his system now.
It's great as well, looking back on it, that Kiko Casilla was able to put that night behind him and bravely stay for another season at Leeds United. I'm even more grateful for that as the days and weeks go by.
There's basically not a scrap of sympathy for him at all, is there?
He's an interesting character, isn't he?
I mean, I know.
There's a future video fucking coming here, isn't there?
He deserves one, the prick. How many times has that he's done that this year now? That he's
twice in a minute in the biggest game of the fucking yeah. season.
He's already done it at Ipswich. He did it twice. He threatens to do it in every single game.
And it's like I was in my naivety. I was thinking during the second half, oh, we'll get to Wembley and Villa will just balls on the edge of the box and just see how many times they can score like that. But then Derby did it first.
You just need to coax him out, don't you? So anything that'll tempt him from his box.
I took a photo and I tweeted it at halftime of him. It's when we're attacking a corner, so it's all right. But he's standing, he's the only player in our half, but he's standing in the centre circle. And I was like, this is a little bit too much. But then when their first goal, it was like he was standing a long way out of his goal, but somehow still not far enough out to get to the ball.
Well, the one between him and Cooper.
Yeah. It was like he's miles out of his goal to be the problem
with that one, because it was like 90 degrees to me, was that it ran through between the two of them and there was just that half second of one of them saying, you get it, no, you get it. And
shouldn't be a discussion.
I know. Yeah, Cooper should have seen it all the way back and Kiko should have fucking seen it all the way out.
I think, yeah, it's...
But then Cooper stopped thinking Kiko's coming, then he went for it, lunged, tapped it past him.
Well, that's it. That's what I'm trying to say, is when your keeper is 25 yards out of his goal, any ball over the top, it should be his. But instead, when the ball goes over the top, he has this thing where he's like, oh, Liam, I think you can have that one. He's like, well, what the fuck were you standing 30 yards outside your goal for? And then Cooper's like, and then the one immediately afterwards that they nearly scored from, I'm sure Calvin was going for the ball and a Derby player was dragging him backwards. And that was then when Casilla was like, oh, I have to come and get this. And nobody got there. So cheating Derby pricks were kind of responsible for the second one.
Accurate on reflection. The thing about watching the game back is I'd never really properly looked at the highlights since, and certainly hadn't had the benefit of, I think it's Andy Hinchcliffe did the call commentary. Can't be exactly sure. I've never been able to tell all these years the voices of the co-commentators on Sky just blend into one. And unless they start saying something really dickish about Leeds, and then I could be like, oh, right, it's Don Goodman. I'm never sure if it's Goodman or Hinchcliffe. I think this is Hinchcliffe. But the thing about the Derby goal that we're quite close to getting right talking about it there is that it's Cooper's ball and Cooper deals with it. To an extent, he makes the tackle and he wins the ball and he's sliding. But then the problem is he crashes into Kiko Kassir because Kiko Kassir is standing there like a fucking fool. And then after he's crashed into Kassir, obviously the ball runs out of his control and Marriott's there to just pop it in. And the point they're making on the commentary, and they say it again on the next one when it's Luke Ayling is the one who ends up in dispute with him, is that Kassir doesn't trust his defender. We've always looked at it as like, the defenders don't trust Kassir. It's Kassir doesn't trust the defenders to defend. And their point on the first one is that Kassir needs to be standing a good 15 yards away from that action because Liam Cooper is going to tackle the player and he'll either win the ball or he won't win the ball. If he doesn't win the ball, right, you're the goalkeeper, you're the last line of defence, now it's your turn to try and deal with this. But while Cooper is there and actually dealing with it and doing something about it, there is no need for a goalkeeper to come and stand on his fucking toes. And that's what causes all the problems. So it is 100%. Anybody who sort of says, oh, that was catastrophe, League One Cooper doing that one, I won't have it. It was Kiko Kassir all day long. And the one that happens a minute afterwards always gets spoken about. But then there's one in the second half as well where there's a high ball into the penalty area. I think Derby are putting a corner back in. Berardi is challenging with one of their strikers, I can't remember who. And Kassir takes sort of a run at the both of them and kind of just crashes into the back of Berardi and sends them both flying to the floor. And then he's really lucky, one, that the referee doesn't give a penalty, and Lampard is sprinting up and down the touchlines going, it's a penalty, it's a penalty. And two, that the ball just kind of bounces off Berardi's thigh and into his hands and he can catch it and go, yep, cool, dealt with that situation. That's absolutely fine. But it's one of the stupidest things I've ever seen a goalkeeper do. Berardi is there. He's going to either win the header above his opponent or he's not. And if he doesn't, then okay, there's going to be a loose ball in the penalty area and you can leap on that, get your hands on it, fine. What Berardi doesn't need is his goalkeeper coming and shoving him in the back so he ends up on the ground. Fucking idiot. Why didn't he just fuck off then? Apparently that night he went to Bielsa and was like, oh no, I have to come back and make this right. Fucking tell Jonathan Lico what he came back and made right. He's still not made that right. Still not apologised. And if he just fucked off then.
Because I've not watched this game back before, certainly not the full thing, I've never actually seen the second Kiko incident again. And I didn't have the full 90 to hand, so I was trying to look up some detail of it. And from The Guardian, minute by minute, I think it probably sums it up. Bear in mind, this is from neutrals as well, so this is not with a Leeds, Jesus Christ, everything's going wrong, panic about it. It says, Kassir has completely lost the plot. The Leeds goalkeeper, who is all over the place, decides to make amends for racing out of his area to deal with a loose ball by racing out of his area to deal with another loose ball. Once again, he's nowhere near it. His presence is only spreading alarm, which I think should really be, that'll be on his gravestone probably. And he's very lucky not to be punished again when the ball squirts clear. The Leeds fans howl. This has turned.
And turned it hard.
The thing of him standing so far out of his goal to sweep up is absolutely fine. But where he has that short circuit is in not seeing that another Leeds player can deal with a ball. He has to go and get involved, whereas what he should be doing in both these situations is backpedaling and sort of getting himself away from the situation so he's got a view of what's happening and he can let... Liam Cooper's a good defender. He can deal with that. He doesn't need fucking nonsense getting in his way. And if that hadn't happened, we'd probably... we'd have been in the Premier League a year ago, so we'd have been signalling our relegation at the moment.
The thing with Kassir, this was at the point where I think we all still wanted to believe in him. I certainly did. I wanted to believe that he was a better keeper than this showed. But I think now that we've seen what happened with his, you know, mental collapse this season and the Lico incident and all that, it's obviously weighed on him. But I think we've realised now because we've had that extra evidence that he genuinely is not very good. At this point, though, the Derby game, I still wanted him to be good. I wanted him to have not made that mistake.
Well, he'd only replaced Bailey Peacock Farrell, hadn't he? So you kind of hope whoever you bring in is better than Bailey Peacock Farrell, because I never thought it was any good.
How dare you?
I know, I'm sorry. Controversial with you. You're around, I know. And he had won stuff and been at good clubs. Well, I mean, he'd be sat on a bench while other people won stuff, but they'd had him around. So you kind of think, well, he must have been all right. Because he'd done it right before as well in the Ipswich game, hadn't he, as we mentioned. And he'd not, as I remember, made very many good saves. He made a really good save. I think it was his debut against Rotherham. And aside from that, I think he was basically a disaster. And then the start of this season, he improved slightly and then became more and more of a liability as it went on. So can't wait for him to be starting in the Premier League next year.
And the Lico thing was the thing, I think, for me, that just kind of tips me over the edge with him, where I thought he is and always was more trouble than he's worth, and we should just get rid of him and not have him as our problem anymore.
Yeah, Ilyan Meslier seems like a nice, quiet fellow. You know, we're not going to get any trouble with him. He'll make mistakes, all goalkeepers do. But if he does make a mistake, he might apologise, which is the big thing that Kiko Kassir has never caught that memo.
Interesting how we didn't really point the finger at Cooper at all, even though in this game we saw the kind of the returns and the worst of League One. Liam, you forget just how far they've come in yet another season. This extra year in that division has really brought them on leaps and bounds, because you'd have to say Cooper was pretty faultless in the 2019-20 season, whereas we saw League One Liam in this game with that penalty was just stupid to pull the shirt like he did.
You can see him doing it. And in fairness, it's the sort of thing that generally as a defender you get away with, because people don't go down as easily. Because obviously, like, holding someone's shirt for a brief second doesn't make them fall over. And he does grab hold of him. And as he starts going down, he lets go almost in a like, oh, no, don't do that, please. And you can see him pulling his arms away, but it's too late. And Anthony Taylor has at that point already decided that he's going to give it, which is one of those where, I mean, it is a penalty, unfortunately. There's not a huge amount you can defend around it. Though Anthony Taylor does get away with booking Bamford for what on reflection, I still think is probably a penalty. The one that Richard Keogh sort of bumps into the back of him and then spits in his face straight after it. Not on purpose, it's just the way Richard Keogh speaks, unfortunately. It wasn't a Saez type thing. But Don Goodman stroke Andy Hinchcliffe said the referee got it absolutely spot on when he booked Bamford for diving. But I don't know, what do you think of it, Moscow? You haven't watched it back. I still think it certainly is in the seen him given sort of category.
Yeah, it is. Bamford does kind of, I think he's forgotten that he's the focus of diving controversy at the time, because he does throw his arms in the air and turn around at the ref. But the thing with Cooper's penalty against him later is that Richard Keogh spent all night. There's basically one incident in particular where the camera just has him and Bamford in the corner of the screen as the ball goes over them. And he's basically strangling Pat Bamford. And there's a couple of those, and one of them as well, Keogh does a much, much worse dive than Bamford has ever done in his entire life to win a free kick. And I think Cooper may have had in his mind, like, all right, well, if Richard Keogh can basically duff our striker up that way, I can have a little cheeky pull at this guy and it won't be a problem. But it's different for Leeds players, isn't it?
Let's speak of Bamford, because we were a little bit critical of him in the aftermath of this game, but not necessarily for the things that we've criticised him for in the most recent season, which has basically just been about his killer instinct and his finishing. And, you know, let's caveat that by saying, as we did on the other podcast, that he did what he needed to do this season. He's answered the questions, even if his finishing could sometimes leave something to be desired. He did enough to get us over the line, so we'll see what happens in the next season. However, going back a year, we were picking up on different things.
Bamford tonight was just so bad. I've mentioned before that I'm in the vicinity of Norman Hunter when I've been watching these games on the gantry. And he, at one point, I thought he was going to just grab the nearest posh lad he could find and just bang their head off the floor. He turned to me with his fists clenched and his arms out and his teeth clenched and was just like, he was a very, very angry man with Bamford's performance. And But we were saying, we got the car back together, is the bloke isn't fit, is he? You could see it.
Probably not. But the thing is, in the first leg and in the previous games against Derby, like Keogh has had absolutely no idea where Roof is. Yeah. He moves in and around him. Not in him, that'd be weird. Just around him. He moves just around him, and Keogh's got a constant looking over his shoulder, not knowing where he is. Mm. He always knew where Bamford was today. He was stood next to him, waif-like, just waiting to allow him to win the ball.
Pat Bamford doesn't run. That's the problem with him. Which I think does show that he wasn't fit. Because we do acknowledge that he's had these bad injuries and things, but I remember this game as him just not looking like he was trying, but I think maybe he was just not capable of trying and we had no other options, so he had to play, unfortunately.
Yeah, he wasn't fully fit. He was coming back. And if Kemal Roof hadn't been injured in the first leg, then Roof would have started. And we say that quite a lot on the Groovecast, that I was convinced that if Roof had played, we'd be going to Wembley. And it was that simple. And so it was a combination with Bamford of him lacking fitness and Keogh, who was just all over him and horrible to him all night.
Another thing you notice from Keogh, even from the highlights of the goals, is that Keogh seems to have been allowed freedom to just roam upfield, which I think fitter Pat Bamford ends up tracking him back and stopping some of those things happening. Like there's bits where he's just running through. I think it's there. Again, lost track of the goals. I think it's the second goal where he basically just waltzes through the middle and plays a through ball. And you kind of think, I don't think we would have allowed that to happen this year. And not only because Richard Keogh's knees are in the backseat of a car still.
The other thing that stood out for me from watching it back is that Pablo Hernandez was awful. He tried, his attempts at creativity were nowhere near coming off. And then that second goal, the one straight after half time, it's scored in the right back position. And Luke Ayling has just gone bombing forward. And you can see on the replay, you see Pablo Hernandez is kind of tracking whoever it is that scored the goal. He's kind of tracking him from midfield. And then there's a 1-2 as the ball goes through, and he just kind of stops to a jog, and then there's nobody in the gap. Jamie Shackleton's running back as well. It happens for the last Derby goal as well. It happens in that area, and it's Shackleton is kind of running back, but then I think he kind of thinks he's handing the player on to Hernandez, but Hernandez is just like, I'm a flighty creative playmaker. I don't know why you think I would be running back there. And I think at 34 years old as well, it's not really what you wanted Pablo Hernandez to have been doing. The point on the defensive actions for those goals is maybe less that Pablo Hernandez wasn't tracking back and should be ashamed of himself. Maybe more that we were missing the fact Alioski was injured and was flouncing around on the sidelines in a very spectacular jacket instead of storming up and down the wings the way that Jackie and Dallas were on the other side. The goals came from the right back area, and it was, from my perspective, looking back at the whole game, it seemed like because we were bombing forward with our full backs, Ayling and Dallas as two of our most potent attacking players, we just didn't have the legs on the right side to track Derby's runners, of which there were many, because they did. Lampard's tactic was get everybody forward and have a go at them, and that worked for them. But yeah, but Pablo in general didn't produce much. It wasn't his game. Essentially, it was too frantic. They should have given him a little bit more space and told everybody to slow down so he could play some magical through balls.
It's funny you mentioned Dallas. I was thinking back. We talked about him briefly in this, but this game was, I think, was the start of, it was either the start of Dallas being really good or the start of us noticing that he was really good, because he put, obviously scored the two goals in it, and he did seem to be the player who was trying to just get us to Wembley by himself. But I think essentially since this game, he's arguably been our best player, which is strange because I seem to remember earlier in the season last year, I think he played right back against Blackburn and got a bit of a roasting by their winger. And we were all a bit sort of going, I just don't think Dallas is really a fullback. He's fine to, you know, be on the bench or whatever, and he's all right out wide and stuff, but I don't think anyone had a huge amount of love for him. And then he's done something this summer, and he's come back and he's just had the annoyance of Derby gnawing away at him, and it seems to have driven him to ridiculous heights this season.
He's grown into himself, and he came from Brentford. He's supposed to be this tricky winger. He's supposed to be a bit like Pablo Hernandez, and I think he's maybe now, as he's got older, realised just work really fucking hard. That's his strength. That's what he, and that's not to be dismissed. That really is a fantastic asset. And the goal he scores, I don't think any of us could picture it when we were recording straight after the game, but it's a beautiful goal. And he nearly got a hat trick. He had a shot that curled, I can't remember if it hit the post or no, it was a good save actually. It was heading for the top corner and it was saved. And then I think Ayling fires in the shot, or it might be Jack Clark, but it's quite late on. We were close, and he was the one driving us forward and sprinting back again. And that's where he's coming to his own. He's realizing that he has this engine and this energy that is more valuable to the team than tricks and pace.
If we want to talk about some good stuff, Stuart Dallas, who I've thought in before, I've just looked at him and gone like, not really sure what he does. Not had a massive problem with him. I've just sort of found him quite indifferent. Superb tonight. And there was one moment, I think it was when we were, no, it was in, yeah, it's the sequence before he scored his second, when we were behind on aggregate, and Leeds are kind of kicking the ball around. It's all looking a bit milky. And he barged into a challenge, won the ball, drove upfield, and was the one player going like, no, I'm taking this by the scruff of the neck. And then a minute later, he scored that goal.
It's amazing looking back with a year's hindsight under our belts now at the development of these players and what they've done. And yet Dallas has come on leaps and bounds. And you're absolutely right. This was the first game, I think, where he really stood out. And then returning to Pat Bamford, you've seen the running that he's put in this year. And, you know, we praised that lots this year, his effort and his output. Absolutely fantastic. The thing that we didn't see in that game. And yeah, you realise just how ravaged I think we were by injuries last season and the impact that it had on the final outcome.
That he's had two bad knee injuries this season. And I was thinking about it just now. The first one, they made a big point that his leg apparently looked like it was in the condition it could have been if he'd been in a serious car accident. And you think normally, oh, well, that's going to put him out for the season. It got him back in 3 months. And then he had another knee injury that kept him out for about 6 weeks. And you don't have two serious knee injuries in the space of 4 months and then come back playing at your best. So hopefully, I mean, who knows, we might sell the bastard now. So it doesn't matter. Like, hopefully he'll come back next season in scoring form, or he'll just go away and we'll sign somebody better.
Eddie Nketiah, Jean-Kevin Augustin. They couldn't do it against the player with the mangled leg.
Quite ironic, given that we were spoken about Keo being absolutely all over Bamford in this game and describing Bamford's knees as being like a car crash. Amazing how that one panned out.
Not my words, the words of Rob Price, his actual doctor, who had that assessment of his poorly legs.
Maybe Richard Keogh should give him a ring, get him back for pre-season.
And the upshot of this was, Michael, you wanted him on the roids and in the gym with Salim Lamrani. And we did see a more beefy Bamford when it came to this season. I mean, obviously Bielsa has him all stick thin and all that, but he certainly was. He added more physicality to his game, I think is the phrase.
Yeah, he did, definitely. And I think for his faults this season, a lack of effort, and sometimes his physicality is not used particularly well. Like, you can just see he gets annoyed and you can see him going for a ball and he's got in his head, I'm going to give him a massive shove here. And everyone can see that, so he gives free kicks away, whereas like a more canny operator is like standing on people's toes and dead-legging people on the sly and stuff. But he's put in a huge amount of effort this season, and I think his performance in this game is not been anything like the performances he's put in this season.
He did say that at the start of this season as well, that it was a deliberate intent that he was going to stop being bullied by the likes of Richard Keogh, that he was going to stand up for himself a bit more in attack. And the net result this season, we'll always remember, he is top scorer for the league champions, and he'll always have that to dine out on.
This one, a game that for many people tipped them over the edge when it came to Berardi with him getting sent off. Although it did feel like it had all kind of got away from us already by the point he was shown that card. Didn't help though.
There was still time left, wasn't there? And it did feel quite unjust. I mean, I'll play the clip now, but this is us watching his sending off again, I think for the first time. I don't think any of us had seen it back since. But my impression leaving the stadium was that the ref should have given him a couple of free kicks before he was allowed to chop someone. But this is us watching it live and watching the replay live, and you can kind of tell we don't disagree with the actual decision to send him off.
But somebody just did enough to pull him back, and I thought, that's a free kick.
He's gone mad, hasn't he? Here it is.
The one, foul.
So he turned back with it. He got clipped, fouled. He's been fouled twice there.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely you can't complain about the actual thing.
Yeah, no, that's a booking.
I mean, it's potentially straight red there.
Is essential. Norman Hunter didn't think so. Norman did turn to me, he's like, well, is he sent him off for that? I said, two yellows. He was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, he didn't see anything wrong with this particularly. It maybe was a blow. Looking at the we weren't looking at these at the time, but I've just gone back to SofaScore's coverage of the game where they do these momentum graphs. And as you might suspect, we were all over them. The first half is, yeah, it's about 80% us attacking. And then between their penalty and then what I guess is Berardi being sent off, it's all us. And the green bars on the chart are really high, which means we were attacking really hard, not just doing lots of it, but doing it with depth, trying to keep this clean. But even after Berardi was sent off, it's not like we immediately became terrible. We still had chances after that. And we know from Leeds United of old, not of old, but Leeds under Bielsa, that we play just as well with 10 players as we do with 11. There was no particular problem. Where it cost us was it came in combination with Bamford really tiring. It was noticeable that when we were getting the ball forward, it wasn't sticking in Derby's half. We'd done the thing up until then of basically not letting Derby into our half. We were just constantly attacking. With Bamford's fitness, seemed like it went off a cliff towards the end of this game, and so did Berardi's temper. The two things meant that we had to reshuffle. There was less support for Bamford up front, and the pressure started coming back on us more. But I wouldn't say it was Berardi only that meant that Derby County came through and scored that winner, because it was scored in pretty much the same way as the other goals when we had 11 on the pitch, where they attacked down that side and found room and scored.
We'll do our hopes and predictions that we laid out after this game in the second half, but just have a quick rifle through these. The things that we've kind of forgotten about this game that happened. I mean, we will get onto Lampard in depth as well in the second half of the show, but you mentioned before as well, Bamford being booked when he should have had a penalty, and his reputation at that point going before him because of the dive against Aston Villa. Izzy Brown replaced him in this game eventually. The madness of Izzy Brown.
I knew Izzy Brown had played, but I didn't remember he'd been brought on up front for it was his debut, wasn't it?
He'd played once before. He played at QPR and
he came
awful.
On and looked terrible, didn't he? Yeah. Nearly got sent. Should have been sent off, shouldn't he? Yeah. Within about the first 5 minutes, I think he got booked more or less instantly, then did another tackle. You could see him looking at the ref being like, oh no, please no. And he let him off. But yeah, that was odd. I'd also forgotten that they had a man sent off as well, which was right at the end. But at that point, part of the thing would have been if we could have just pushed it to extra time, it would have given us a little bit of something to cling to, I guess.
Yeah, and Izzy Brown took that free kick on the edge of the box, ballooned it into the cop, and he also, in their penalty area, he shoved one of their defenders over as we were attacking, which wasn't particularly helpful. The thing that I'd completely forgotten about that we didn't speak about at the time was in the first half when, and this comes back to me calling their players a bunch of horrible, unpleasant Hernandez getting shoved over by the face in the technical areas. And I think it was, I can't remember which one of their players it was. I mean, that's bad enough. And it should have had more than the yellow card that he got. And Pablo Hernandez also got booked because as he was eventually getting up, he had all sorts. He had Richard Keogh coming around, getting in his face saying, oh, he didn't touch your face. Why are you faking it? And then when you watch the replay, it's a hand in the face and then shoving him over. I think it's Scott Malone then comes and he comes running up to the referee, screaming things at him. And the referee obviously says to him, right, you're not speaking to me like that. And he puts on this face that is a full kind of Weatherspoon face, as if he's going to the bouncer, and he can see him going, what? What? As he was going, like, what are you going to do? What? What? And so Anthony Taylor, the referee, absolutely right. He says, right, I'll tell you what, just yellow card, as simple as that. But it's the attitude that he shows and the lack of respect seem to just completely characterise the entire Derby team in that game and then carrying on into this season, where there's just that sense of Division 2 entitlement that he thinks that because he plays for Derby County and he's probably, you know, he's the biggest thing in all the nightclubs in Derbyshire, that he can go running up to a Premier League referee, you scream whatever he wants in his face, and then when the referee tells him to stop, he's going to be, what? 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 And it's such an unpleasant bunch of fucking And the original incident of just, there's nothing in it. It's Pablo Hernandez. It's a throw into Leeds, and he's basically collecting the ball to take a throw in. This guy comes in and just like slams into the floor for absolutely no reason. Just fuck off, the lot of them.
Going back to the stats on it as well that you mentioned about how much we were attacking, I didn't realise this as well. Do you know how many shots they had in the entire tie across both games? How many shots on target?
I do know, actually.
Four. Jammy, fucking, dirty, horrible bastards. We're not quite over this yet, are we?
The first shot they had on target was their goal. All season.
Oh, goodness me. Other things to remember, they also had somebody sent off. Jack Clark played. Do you remember him? Young Jackie Clark.
Whatever happened to him?
He's no Jackie.
No, he's definitely Jack, isn't he? Yeah, we had high hopes for him, didn't we, at one point? Never mind. He's rich. I'm sure he'll be fine.
Not our problem.
So the WhatsApp mailbag now then, and we are going to do a misty-eyed promotion spectacular, because I don't know if you've heard, we've been promoted to the Premier League as champions. On this topic then, got some questions that have come in, a variety of angles on it. First one up then from Joe.
All right, lads, I'm sure you've been enjoying the promotion party like we all have, but I've been thinking about what has been the best time when we've actually spoiled someone else's party. A bit of schadenfreude, you know, thinking of maybe Watford away, when Don Polion assaulted the goalkeeper and we won, stopped them going up to that.
That was a good one, I have to say, the Watford one, particularly being able to see the reaction of Watford fans who wanted Don Polion immediately imprisoned for attempted murder, because they were like, he knows, he's got ninja skills, he knows exactly what happens when he pushes him there, he can see what's going to, he's going to collide and he's going to almost lose his head and his career, and oh, what an absolutely evil man, which Don Polion never struck me as, I have to say. He seemed like a good lad until we sold him unceremoniously.
I mean, speaking for me, it doesn't actually relate to our Football League stay, but I very much enjoyed, more than I thought I would, when Jimmy Hasselbank scored that diving header against Arsenal to deny them the title and it gave it to the scumbags. It was an unexpectedly happy moment, that one for me.
Yeah, I remember going to that game and before thinking, oh, I don't really care if we win, like I'd actually almost quite like us to lose. But then when it went in, it was like, ah, fuck it. What's the point? You don't go to Leeds games to watch us not win, do you? This is great. And it shows that we're good for next season as well.
Yeah, mine, the first thing that came to my mind predates being in the Football League as well. But it's not really somebody else's party as such. But I did like that Middlesbrough came to Elland Road at the end of the 1996-97 season when we were terrible and we relegated them and made their day worse by showing absolutely no sympathy whatsoever. Juninho, very talented player, one of the, you know, a fantastic Brazilian samba star, all the cliches, a pleasure to watch him play, crying, and you'd think your heart would go out to him. Nah, laughter all around the stadium. It was hilarious and still funny. I think I'm fairly sure it's on the end of the season review video, which is a real, it's a grind of a watch, bearing in mind we played more games than we scored goals that season, and we didn't even concede that many either. So there's not really a lot to recommend that video until you get to the payoff at the end. And it's, look, here's a brilliant footballer in tears. Fantastic. That's what I like to see.
My one's a very niche one, which you would only know about. And it was more of an attempt to spoil someone's party was this one, but when we played Barnsley away in 2013, Dickie Bird had just been awarded an OBE in the New Year's Honours. And my mate Gat, who we go to games with, he had a long-running grudge against him because when his, I can't remember the exact age he was, but when he was a kid, he's massively into cricket as well, his granddad had seen Dickie Bird somewhere and asked him to sign something. And Dickie Bird wanted a fiver for an autograph, even though it was for a child. So my mate absolutely hates him. So, well, I mean, he's a bit of a knob, isn't he, Dickie Bird, but Yorkshireman and all that. So he was getting generally fairly polite applause from the away end, apart from my mate who's going, fuck off, Bird, stop clapping him, he's you're robbing Bird, fuck off, I hope you die, Bird, just shouting that at him for the entire time he was being paraded on the pitch. So that was a nice moment.
We're a right set of bastards whether we win, lose or draw. Love it. Right, let's do this question now from Dominic.
Hi lads, so the last 16 years outside the Premier League we've had some very weird, strange, only Leeds moments. And when you look at the last 10, a lot of those have centred around social media. From McCormack calling fans out to don't go to bed just yet, even with yourselves, GFH, tweeting you for transfers. But out of all the social media moments of the last 16 years, what's been your favourite or the most Leeds moment? Thanks, guys.
Touch of the Ken Bates is there about Dominic, isn't there? Sorry, Ken, Dominic, whichever.
I think the Vern Troyer thing for me was one of those, just for the sheer like surreal nature of it. And it was one of those odd ones that like people outside of Leeds fans wanted to talk to me about. And I really had nothing to say about it. I kind of got to work and other people had seen it. And I said, was Mini-Me there? And he sort of went, yeah. Like, why? Like, I don't know. It's just the way Leeds is at the moment. Why wouldn't he be there?
On a similar tip, I enjoyed it when, and it's not directly Leeds United related, but I enjoyed it when Terry George was hanging around with Chelino a lot and people started exposing some of his more fantastical, well, the more fantastical elements of his life. I think it was the one where, was it Jonathan Ross and Arnold Schwarzenegger were sat having a discussion around Terry George's dining room table in his castle, wherever it is that he lives. And somebody found that photo. And then the fact that he had photoshopped himself into this photo. He'd taken a separate photo and clipped himself out of it and inserted himself into this conversation, and he wasn't even there. That was glorious. But my other favourite one, GFH, that era of madness, when David Haig got side before self wrong, when he tried to tweet that out late one Saturday night. And I think it was because of what it indicated, and it was such a short tweet, and it was just a small mistake, but it revealed so much.
He got it wrong twice, didn't he?
Three times.
I mean, it's really not a complicated quote either, is it? It's not like he's trying to remember a full verse of Shakespeare or something. You obviously remember this better. In what way did he get it wrong then?
It was something like team before self, Billy Bremner, and then side before self. And then he got it, I think he might have even got it right and then just deleted it because he'd missed off Billy Bremner's name or something. It was in... at the same time, the same night, it was very late at night, he was retweeting David Bowie songs, and there was another band as well, I can't remember the other act he was retweeting, but he was retweeting them because they'd been posted on Pamela Anderson's Twitter account, so he was retweeting her posting David Bowie songs. I mean, I was reminded when I wrote that big long article about the last 16 years for me in place of my Derby match report, that when one of his first interviews that he did after GFH took over at Leeds was, he said, oh yes, Leeds United, they're like a young Pamela Anderson, great assets and a bright future. Oh God.
Trying to be one of the lads.
He probably counts as well. I mean, the photo of him at the Brit Awards with Cole Chelino, it was one of those where he's like, what's happening? Why is this going on? Because they were essentially nobodies. And yet here they are somehow living it up at the Brits.
I do quite like the fact that Angus doesn't have a Twitter account now. I just think it's better. I know Red Rosani does, and he's occasionally not always brilliant with it. But I think Kinnear is the man who's running stuff day to day, and I think it's just better that you don't. I'm sure he's got an account to browse what's going on and stuff, but just don't post anything of your personal life on there.
Well, you remember, I mean, Urkel Chelino was actually my pick for the memories. He was the less idiotic-looking brother. He wasn't the Burger King kid, but ended up being almost more stupid because he's the one who, when he had his head shaved while his Instagram bio, claimed that he was the vice president of Leeds United and posted it on Instagram with the hashtag Nazi. And then when people said, that's not really appropriate, he took it down and posted it again with the hashtags SS and hashtag Gestapo. Which, funnily enough, didn't solve the situation. But even before...
Different things. They're different things. They're not even connected, surely.
Even before they'd taken over the club, it was Urkel who... So there were two competing groups. There was Massimo Cellino, who was in the driving seat, and then there was Mike Farnan, who used to be Sunderland's marketing director, and he was a rival bidder. And the arena of the takeover moved from legal departments and solicitors' offices to Instagram, where Urkel was essentially bullying Mike Farnan's daughter, Poppy, who was on, series 2 of Love Island, I think she was on, and she posted a a couple of selfies, and he just went on one, and he went, and he wrote in the comments, cringe, ugly. And then on another one, you make puke.
I remember you make puke. That was a great one.
This is the level that our takeover came to. It was also when Eleonora Cellino, before the takeover was confirmed, was debating in her Instagram comments. There'd basically be a photograph of her with her arse out, and then loads of Leeds fans in the comments saying, is your dad going to complete the takeover? And other people like sending bits of news saying, like, I don't know if you've seen, but there's been a rival bid from such and such. And you could just imagine her going to her dad and saying, oh, but Papa, have you seen this latest news? It's like, well, and on the phone to his lawyers, and somebody on my daughter's Instagram, yeah, find the picture of her ass on there. What's this guy talking about? It was just it was an exceptionally weird time. And we did, there were a couple of sincere people saying, tell your dad to sign a left back. And after we mentioned it on the podcast, I did notice a big increase in the number of people commenting on basically every photo she posted saying, sign a left back. Bless her. She's made her account is currently private. I've just had a look. Ercole is still, he's still all public. And his bio now says vice president of Brescia.
I wonder how he keeps getting these jobs.
An experienced football administrator like him.
I guess so, yeah. We're going to talk about Frank Lampard later, aren't we? So.
Yeah, right then, let's crack on to Riley's question.
G'day, fellas. This is one that I thought up when I was quite pissed post-promotion, and I mentioned to Michael on the live stream the other day, but I wanted to get your thoughts on what your most sort of innocuous great memories of the last 10 or so years have been, just those ones that you shouldn't remember, but you do. I mentioned on the stream, Dexter Blackstock scoring with his first touch. I think I said it was Nottingham Forest, but it was Huddersfield Town from memory. Not sure why, but for a long time, that was my highlight as a Leeds supporter. So I'd be keen to hear your thoughts on just those bizarre goals or moments that you remember and cherish. I don't expect you to send a mug to Melbourne, by the way, but love your work, and here we go.
I must confess, when he said, spoke to Michael on the live stream, I thought, oh, did he? God, it was late. It was late, but then I did remember, yes, I did speak to a man in Australia. I think he was in his garden. It looked very pleasant. It looked certainly much nicer than Pontefract at 2 a.m. or whenever it was.
He writes for the magazine. Riley is a noted writer for the Squareball magazine that you pretend to have some involvement in.
I stand and sell it sometimes. Well, I don't. I drop some boxes off and go to the pub with Oddy, but... yeah, in terms of the actual games and stuff, like, I don't know. I feel like we've covered most of those. So I would instead go in for the random promotional stuff that we got involved in. Now we've got Adidas and Premier League glitz and glamour and stuff. I feel like we can look back and laugh at the days when we had Ainsley Harriott couscous for sale in Cup of Soups in the club shop, and the fact that the club obviously had some major tie-in with Flamingoland. So we had to make a huge website article and photo gallery of Ben Fry soaking wet on a log flume and Neil Warnock's on a motorbike and stuff like that. Just, it was the tin pot stuff. Now we're big time and amazing. I feel like I can properly look back at that and enjoy it in its own sick sort of way.
For me, it was the night of the Chevy Spark, which has significance in retrospect. I don't think we realised at the time that Massimo Cellino was trying to get Gianluca Festa onto the bench for this one. The main thing that occupied our time during Leeds United 1, Ipswich Town 1 in January 2014 was that somebody had parked their Chevrolet Spark registration LT12FNE in the wrong place, and that the PA system kept going on and on about the driver needing to go and move it, to the point where they put it in massive letters on the big screen. Chevy Spark LT12FNE, please contact the nearest steward. There is actually, I found, while just checking my memory on this, I found a very random short blog post about it saying, describing the driver as the most stupid and boneheaded football supporter who happened to be at Leeds United on Tuesday night, parked the car in the wrong place, and despite umpteen public address calls to move it, he obviously ignored them as they put this message on the big screen. The message stayed there for quite a time, so draw your own conclusions. But on the other hand, there is some light in this shade. The fact that Leeds United could program the screen like this is impressive. I wouldn't have been so polite. There is also, and this will sound strange, I genuinely don't know if I started the LUFC Chevy Spark Twitter account or if it was somebody else, because it's 6 years ago. But I have this memory that it might have been me and that I was arguing with a couple of people who they both have locked accounts, so I can't recreate what the actual thing was. But then it says some of the things do sound a bit like me. Hey, the joy of losing is in finding. So will the owner of a Chevy Spark LT12FNE please report to the nearest steward? That does seem like the kind of thing I might have thought was funny. Will owner of a Chevy Spark LT12FNE please report to the nearest steward? Reel to reel and a mad stuntman would like you to move it, move it. I've just had a look for said car. It failed an MOT in 2015. So about a year after this, it's both front tyres were not fitted in accordance with sidewall instructions. So it failed the MOT on that. And it passed, though. It's had a lot of trouble with the front.
They are little tin can things, aren't they? Chevrolet Spark. I wouldn't want to have a crashing one.
Yeah, the front tyres for a few years of running were worn close to the legal limits, but still passable. And then there's a lot of advisories on the front brake pipe being corroded and the offside front brake pipe corroded. And the brake pipes were fucked, basically. Near side rear brake pipe excessively corroded. Fail in March this year, but then repaired the next day. So it is on the road with 61,668 miles on the clock. A silver Chevy Spark LT12FNE.
If you can prove ownership of it, we'll give you a mug. Send us your V5 or whatever it is.
Back to the Griefcast. Hopes, fears, predictions. What do we get right? What do we get wrong?
To go on to Lampard straight away, I think. We did predict that he would be unbearable and leave Derby and fail upwards, but we didn't, even in this time of the entitlement we saw from him, we didn't think he'd fail quite as high as Chelsea. We predicted Brighton, which was not a bad guess because it seemed kind of a logical next step, but nope. Frank missed that lower mid-table Premier League step altogether and went straight for the Champions League.
The entitled arsehole?
He's not had any help, though, has he? He started from the bottom. Now he's working at the club that employed him for years. Yeah, he was horrible in this game. And he's been horrible since. We're speaking in the wake of him banging on to Jurgen Klopp about the touchline code. And I think Klopp's attitude towards him during that incident has been absolutely perfect, where he's basically, like, in the realms of football management, Jurgen Klopp is an adult. Frank Lampard is a child. And you don't go and tell the adults what to do. Touchline code. I think Jurgen Klopp has spent enough time on enough touchlines to know what the touchline fucking code is. And he doesn't need to hear it from that little whinge bag.
Also, in the aftermath of this game, there was the Frank Lampard's bar bill posted online, wasn't there? Of saying, like, oh, they'd all had a big boozy night and stuff. Which, on reflection, given what happened at Derby this season, it does make you wonder, doesn't it, if maybe he was instilling the right things. The code, the moral code that he was giving to those young men was maybe not the greatest, but he just wanted to be one of the lads again, didn't he? I'm one of their boys still. I know I'm a bit older, but I look good for my age, don't I? I'm still young. I can still mix it with you lads. Where are we going? Are we going to a club later? Pathetic. In your suit, Frank. Are you kidding?
Watching the celebrations at the end, they line up the police in front of the away fans, and then the players are all dancing up and down and doing whatever. And then he comes and inserts himself in front of the players, but ahead of them all, in front of the line of the police. And it really does look like from a hooligan CCTV footage where one guy's gone up and he's decided to fucking give it in the face of all the officers who are just standing there. And he doesn't even ask. He just forces his way between two of them. And I think they're a little bit like, what are you doing? And he kind of gets between them and throws a scarf into the crowd and then turns around and walks back. But it's like, I mean, I don't want to get too heavy on this, but people do talk about privilege. The idea that you can just barge your way past a police officer who, even if you are a football manager in that realm, I think the police officer is probably still the person with the authority and is lining up in front of those supporters and keeping the players back for a reason. To think you can just go like, well, I'm fucking Frank Lampard, I think I'll just walk past these police officers because nothing is going to happen to me, because it never ever fucking does.
They should have tasered him, is what you're saying.
Yes. I mean, nobody else under those circumstances, and, you know, the players, quite rightly, are all staying on one side of that line of police because that's what you do. But not if you're Frank Lampard. You're just like, no, the police don't affect me.
I mean, the taser is a good idea. I would have personally opted for the pepper spray, and then you would have been rubbing your fucking eyes, wouldn't you?
and a good shoe-in, just to finish it off.
So what else did we predict then about this one? Derby will still be Derby. That was an interesting prediction. If Villa don't go up, I think they'll be very strong next year. They went up, they were shite, but Derby will still be Derby. And that's how it played out.
Yeah, we had far too much respect for Villa in this because we were talking about had we got to the playoff final, we'd have lost to them. I think at the time, they were riding a bit of a wave, weren't they, going into the playoffs, and they'd been on a good run of form. But actually, turns out they're not very good. But the Derby will still just be Derby thing was absolutely spot on, because I don't even know where they finished this year. 10th, 12th, 13th? Who cares? Not bothered. Nowhere is where they finished.
Yeah, they got bang up for this game, and that's what got them through it. But their actual average level of play and ability and character and moral fibre and relevance to the sport of football and the world in general, nothing.
Mosco, you made a bold prediction as well. Have a listen to this.
Is it time yet to talk about it being a two-year process? Or have we? I've not checked Twitter. Has Bielsa quit yet?
Not yet, but he was struggling to get his words out on Sky. Is the tweet that I've just seen.
Oh, why have they made him go on Sky, for crying out loud? Just
oh, do you know what the that final as well? John Terry and Frank Lampard. Oh, it's irrelevant. Cole, it's just dreadful.
It's
isn't
just
it?
A matter of which one of those teams we absolutely hammer on our way to winning the championship by a record margin next season.
Wasn't quite a record margin, but it was a big margin in the end, wasn't it?
Yes. The other thing I look back on with a certain amount of alarm is that I was talking quite a lot about how we'd wasted the loan places, three of them, Blackman, Brown and Baker, and that if we made better use of those loan positions and the money that we made on them, we'd have a much stronger squad. And apparently, from everything I've read, that's one of the things that Bielsa went straight to Angus Kinnear and Victor Orta and Radric Sani and said, if I'm coming back next season, we're not wasting these loan positions. We're going to make much, much better use of these loan places. And so essentially me and Marcelo Bielsa just sharing a brain out here.
I mean, the loans this year, they have undoubtedly been better, I think. Ben White has obviously been, well, given what's been achieved this year, I'd say it's probably our best loan ever. Is that fair? I'm trying to think if I've missed anyone out, obvious, but I mean, Mickey Doyle might be a bit upset by it, but he played pretty much every game in a title-winning season, didn't he? Well, it was promotion-winning season.
I agree that Ben White is on a par with Michael Doyle.
Why don't we just get Michael Doyle? It'd be cheaper. Get him back in. But, I mean, I suppose that Nketiah was a mixed sort of a... He was half a successful, wasn't he? Scored a few important goals for us, won us some points, which were crucial at the time, but it wasn't actually brilliant. Jackie Harrison came back, but I don't know, and then John Kevin Augustin, which was obviously a loan to a supposedly permanent transfer at the end of it, we'll wait and see on that, it was pretty much a disaster.
Jack Clark was also a bit of a waste of time, but then I remember Melier was alone, and, you know, we needed him when our supposedly first-choice goalkeeper acted like a dick, and then Helder Costa was also a loan during this season and played a huge part, and Jack Harrison came back and was Jackie who? Harrison.
Oh, okay, sorry.
There you go. So it did work much better. The other thing that we were predicting, or at least hoping for, was a much, much better striker who would finish chances that Pat Bamford didn't. We were expecting or hoping that Kamal Roof would probably be the star of the following season, and we'd sign back up as good as or better than him and Bamford. I think that our general opinion at the time was Bamford could go swizzle just because we were looking for better. But as we said, those lone strikers we mentioned, if Eddie Nketiah was that good, he would have displaced Bamford, and he never did. Therefore, Arsenal, they've got the shit one, we've got the good one.
We did mention the fact that when we were talking about potential transfers out, we did mention Roof as being potentially very saleable after a good season with us, which we did then end up doing. We also talked about Pontus might want to leave for a Premier League club for £20 million, which, well, he left. So we were, does that make us, what, a third right? Quarter right? I'm not sure.
People talk about the risks of Cooper and Berardi making mistakes under pressure. What the fuck was Pontus doing for Brentford in that semi-final? Attempting a...
And he gave away a penalty in the first leg, didn't he? When he overstretched and lost his balance.
He didn't play in this game though, did he, for us? He just sat and sulked at the end, was his input.
Yeah, let's go back to the strikers and hear the clips then of the stuff that we said. And we laid out our demands, first of all, for a better striker.
If we had a striker who could score and was fit, with the chances we create, we would have absolutely stormed this division and we would have been promoted in February. That's the team we've got.
With a monk era, Chris Wood, he would have probably got 30 plus this year.
We don't even need a striker that good. We just need a striker that's more efficient than the strikers that we've been using. I'm really happy with how Kemal Roofe has played this season after really kind of big money move from a lower level team, not really looking like he was fitting anywhere. Flashes, but this season he's really stepped up, and I think his first leg performance was like, yeah, I'm the striker at this club, but let's replace him with a better one.
And not just one, maybe more than one. Imagine that.
It's just nice. It'd be nice to have options, because that's the thing.
Yeah.
The number of weeks where both Bamford and Roofe have been fit and actually properly fit, not returning from an injury. It's probably been at most a month of the whole season that we've had two fit strikers on the books.
Never got that, did we?
No, our idea that he would go to the board and say, I've had a rethink about this small squad idea, just didn't quite work out. We actually were even smaller. Because if you remember last year, we owned both Bamford and Roofe. This year, we only owned Bamford. And we sold Janssen and what's-his-face, Halme, and only brought in Ben White, when I think we would have expected more than just one loan 21-year-old centre-half, but it worked. And I think the other thing we were talking about was whether players like Jamie Shackleton would have more involvement, because he was brilliant in the two legs of the playoff semi-final. As it's turned out, I think this season has relied upon the experienced players. It's been more of a Stuart Dallas, Luke Ayling, Liam Cooper style of victory rather than a Jamie Shackleton, Robbie Gotts event, but they've had another season of training in the first team squad, and I almost have a feeling that players like Shackleton could make a bigger mark in the Premier League straight off than they made in the Championship, where they didn't get the chance because it was just too much at stake to be putting in little boys like them.
And when you factor in the injuries as well, the fact that we've had fewer injuries this year has probably slightly restricted the opportunities for the under-23s and the likes of Shackleton pushing on. But when the time came for them towards the end of the season to step up and step into the team, we saw the leaps forward that like Strike made, for example.
I think it was a good tactic this year to restrict all the injuries to Adam Forshaw. That's helped a lot.
One humorous thing to note from this was the tweet that we put out of the visual that was mocked up by our good friend, The Beating Generation, who put the word carajo in big letters on the seats, and it went viral and it travelled around the world in the run-up to this. And, well, it actually happened this year.
Yeah, it was very funny because it was a ridiculous thing that a football club would write basically the word fuck across their stand for it to be put on TV and for all the world to see. Ridiculous. And then this year, in a ridiculous year, it's what we ended the season with. So I like to think we've had a bit of an influence in that. I think Victor's seen it and gone, you know what? Yes, let's do that. And he's had to settle for it on the stand-upper in the end. I'm sure he probably wanted it as our original mock-up was, but I'm putting this one down to Victor.
So when we recorded the pod on Monday night, at the end of it, almost as an afterthought, you just said, oh, look at this on my phone. It's a photograph of the East Stand with Carajo written across it that our friend The Beaten Generation, TBG 2005 on Twitter, had done. And you go, oh, we'll probably tweet that out tomorrow. No, we didn't think much of it. And then you just put a tweet out and half an hour, a few people were like, oh, that's a really good Photoshop. A few people trying to work out, is that really a Photoshop? How has this been done? A couple of people, that can't be real, but it'd be good if it was. And then a few hours later, it was being tweeted out to 3 million people at a time in South America as real. So things like that, there was no such thing as Vamos Liz Carajo 12 months ago. There was fucking Paul Heckingbottom going like, I'm hoping to get, who are we going to sign? Yaya Dom. I'm going to get Yaya Dom in on a free from Barnsley.
And the overriding sentiment as we left the grief cast, well, what did we leave it on? I can't even really remember. Were we optimistic? Were we in despair? Were we just confused?
There was essentially the big caveat that Bielsa needs to stay and then everything will be fine.
Bielsa on his future. Adam Pope has just tweeted out, if the club offers me the possibility to carry on, I will listen to the proposal.
Accept the proposal, you bastard. Just stay.
Well, if Bielsa stays, I feel fine with everything.
Yeah, we'll have a. Let's imagine, well, it'll be less than 12 months from this day because we'll have had our promotion party in March. The open top bus tour before Easter. It's not impossible. We were good enough. We were good enough to be promoted this season.
Good prediction, Moscow. Just slightly out in that we didn't anticipate the global pandemic. We didn't anticipate lifting the trophy in July rather than March. But we did end up winning at a canter. And we got the open top bus, albeit not on tour.
What on bricks? Suits us down to the ground.
Quiz time. Jamie McMastermind and all that. Apparently I won last time, so it's my go.
You prepared this beautifully, I'm sure.
Right, who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
There's going to be trust involved in this game. But what I want you to do is, starting immediately, so you can't Google it, tell me the EFL Championship table from top to bottom in order that the club's finished. Go.
Oh, Christ.
Leeds United.
Correct. Michael.
West Bromwich Albion.
Brentford Football Club.
Fulham Football Club.
It would then be Swansea City.
Incorrect. No. It was Cardiff City.
Yes.
Oh dear. Well, I mean, the crowd are delighted. Listen to the emotion.
Shouldn't he have to get the next one right?
No, we're just doing something. Well,
you just said it was. Yeah. You just said it was. By default, I have it right. I was hoping to get to Nottingham Forest hilariously in seventh, but never mind.
And when you mentioned Derby being about, I don't know, 10th, 11th, or 12th, you said a little while ago, I thought, oh, hey, up. Hey, up. This is exciting. This is an exciting development, but we didn't even make it that far because Moscow's shite.
Were they 10th, 11th, or 12th?
They were 10th.
There you go. Pathetic. Might as well have been 11th or 12th.
Do you want me to do the full table from top to bottom?
No.
Right, perfect. Let's choose a mug winner.
I quite like the social media one. Dominic?
Yeah.
He did sound a bit like Ken Bates, though, didn't we? Just something to say, but you know.
Maybe we should give him the mug because that was quite mean of you saying that.
All right, then. Dominic, get in touch with us and we'll ping the mug through to you. Just give us a nudge on WhatsApp and we'll do that. And we will return with another episode of The Extra Ball in a bit. Thanks for listening to this one. See you in a bit. Bye.
The Extra Ball.